Hello, podcast listeners.
The podcast listeners.
You almost forgot them, didn't you?
No, never.
First, let me say.
Oh, please.
Well, I got word from our. About.
Raise money?
Yeah, yeah. And I hate to have to do that, so I'll be brief. It'll be a test. I want to thank everyone who has decided to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour. It means a great deal to us, and we are immensely grateful. And I would point out again that the Thomas Jefferson Hour is completely listener-supported. I think I'm safe in saying that.
That is correct.
We have no corporate sponsors. We have no network sponsors or anything like that. It is the listeners of this program who enable us to continue in our ongoing effort to provide civil discourse and in the spirit of Thomas Jefferson. So,
but we frankly do actually need your help. And so if you can help us, we're thrilled. You can always help us by continuing to listen and telling everyone you know. That's the best way to grow the program.
If you would like to support the Jefferson Hour, go to jeffersonhour.com. You can do whatever you want to support the show. And even if you just go there and write us a letter, that's great. But this week, we have an awful lot of fun with our. I start the show by trying to explain to Mr. Jefferson that I have this device and it's going to allow a voice.
That took some time.
Yeah, he was pretty good about it, but sometimes Jefferson just the technology goes over his head and he allows it and suspends his disbelief. And sometimes you have to explain things a little bit.
Well,
here's
my methodology with this, David. I like to make sure that everyone gets it, that there would be some explaining that would have to be done.
Yeah.
In other words, you just don't want to say, oh, glad to take your call, let's go. You know, you want Jefferson to sort of remind us of what's changed.
So we talked to Bo Wright, who spent 5 years in Obama's White House, started as an intern and ended up head of finance.
Running the place, yeah.
Head of finance for, I think.
For the executive branch.
Right, yeah.
No, I mean, just for the White House. So,
right,
so
yeah.
There's a White House budget. Uh-huh. Unlike in Jefferson's time.
So he has a unique perspective that, of course, we were anxious to hear about. But he presented a few facts to the president. The president did not quite grasp, like a million federal employees and the president not having a horse but driving around.
I think, didn't Jefferson ask him where he slept, where his bedroom was in the White House?
Yeah. Oh, it was very interesting that they exchanged information about the architecture.
And, right, and so, Latrobe and L'Enfantin.
It was really fun.
I should just warn those, I mean, this is not a political program, but of course, Bo Wright is a believer that Obama was a great man and a great president, and so there may be people who just find that a little difficult to stomach, but listen and make up your own mind about that.
In his letter to us, he said, on all occasions, both public and private, in which I observed President Obama, he was there, saw him. Not once did I ever see him betray the high honor and great dignity of the office. Had he done so, we rightly would have objected.
As you know, I share that view that whatever you think of Barack Obama, elegant, decorous, superb professional deportment, maybe unprecedented.
We can't thank Bo enough for coming on the show. It was great.
He lives down
really
by
fun.
Lynchburg.
Near Poplar Forest. And we
kind of
tried to strike up a deal to get him to come back on the show and sort of.
I think I might have driven him off because I demanded that he throw a coin across.
You started barking orders at him. Yeah, you did.
I was pretty demanding.
Yeah, you were. Yeah.
But I thought, why not? You know, he's young. You know, if this kid wants a real break in the show, there's going to be some challenges. The Wendover Death March. We could make your career, kid.
Okay, have a good time in London. Say hi to your daughter.
I will be back, and I will have lots to report.
And now to the show.
Thanks for listening.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, sir. You're looking well.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, I have something exciting for you today. As you know, in the past, I've brought in people via this device where you can hear their voice and have a conversation with them. And I have someone on the line today that I think you will find very interesting to talk to, sir.
I'm just still having a hard time believing that there can be a small object through which I can hear the voice of someone who lives more than a few feet from this space.
Well, be that as it may, I'm glad that you accept the fact that it is here and it does exist. I have found a young gentleman who has experience in the White House, sir, during my time, not yours.
I imagine things have changed somewhat.
I imagine they have, sir. The gentleman's name is Beau Wright, and he sent a very kind letter to us and offered to speak with you, as I assumed you would have questions for him. So, Mr. President, let me introduce to you Mr. Beau Wright.
Hello, Mr. President. How are you?
It's an odd thing to meet someone that you have not met, but I'm fascinated by what must have been your experience in the White House. Let me start with a really simple question. Is it the same building?
Yes, sir, though it has been expanded since you were president. So you were probably housed in the executive residence, the executive mansion, the James Hoban-designed building that we all know so well. The campus now comprises 18 acres, including two wings to either side, the West Wing and the East Wing, the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is a massive building designed in the late 19th century, and then many of the townhomes that you may have seen. I'm not sure if they were there in your time, the townhomes along Lafayette Park, just to the north of the White House.
I had a little role in creating what would become the West Wing. If you go to Monticello or Poplar Forest, you will see similar wings to provide extra space, office space, sometimes below the surface of the ground. I was fond of that as a design because it did not break the Palladian facade, at least of Monticello. You know, you bring up James Hoban. I am sorry in a way that you brought it up because, as you perhaps know, I submitted a design for the White House. There was a competition, and I produced one anonymously. I didn't put my name on it. It was red brick, and it had a kind of a dome-like structure, so it would have been a little bit closer to Monticello or perhaps the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., but it was not accepted, and Hoban's building, which is based on Leinster House in Ireland, turned out to be the winner of the competition.
Yes, and I understand that you worked with Mr. Latrobe on the wings. Is that correct?
That is correct. So Latrobe was a very adept architect and designer and builder. And so at first I had worked with Charles-Pierre L'Enfant to help lay out the city. And I had the unfortunate task of having to fire L'Enfant because he was so high-handed. He wanted to pluck down all sorts of houses that were in his way. And he came at it the whole project with a sort of French hauteur. And finally, George Washington insisted that I fire him. But his design, nevertheless, produced the basic grid for the National Capitol. And then Latrobe came to play a much more important role as we actually built the buildings and particularly expanded the White House. Even in my time, the White House was too small. Now, I should say, sir, that in my two terms as president, I lived in that building alone, essentially. My wife was deceased, and my daughters had pressing lives back in Virginia. I did always have a personal secretary, and my private correspondent secretary in the first instance was Meriwether Lewis. And then once he went into the West, he was followed by several others. But the room that Lewis occupied during his time as my personal secretary was the East Room. And I actually, it's a huge room. I divided it in two with a partition. And part of it was his private chambers, his bedchamber. And then the other part was his office. And that worked out well then because we had such a tiny staff. How big a staff in the White House in your time?
Oh, Mr. President, it is quite large. Today, on the president's personal staff, you have roughly 450 individuals, but that does not take into account a number of other federal employees from time to time, we call them detailees from other federal agencies, come to work at the White House. It doesn't take into account the number of military aides who directly serve the president as members of the White House military office. So all in all, several thousand individuals support the president day to day in Washington.
Sir, I'm deeply chagrined to hear this. Is your president the president of a republic or a Persian satrap?
A republic, sir.
So what possible use can there be for hundreds of young men?
Well, Mr. President, the federal government, and you may be surprised and perhaps saddened to hear this, the federal government has now expanded to several million individuals with a plethora, a host of federal departments, from the State Department, which I believe you're quite familiar with, to the Department of Defense, Health and Human Services, the HHS, and just a host of different federal agencies and sub-agencies.
Did you say, sir, there are several million federal employees?
Yes, sir. There are several million federal employees today. And to manage that apparatus as the chief executive of the federal government, the president leans quite heavily on his staff of several hundred, at least primary employees, and then several thousand indirect employees.
So you have to, I think, admit that Hamilton won.
Yes, Mr. President, I'm afraid so.
Alas.
Mr. Jefferson, how many aides did you have in the White House during your presidency?
Well, one, sir. I brought some slaves as servants from Monticello, and they cooked and cleaned and took care of the basic functions of a relatively large house. It was unfinished at the time that I moved in the spring of 1801. And then I hired the son of a friend of mine, Lucy Marks. Her son, Meriwether Lewis, was a remarkable young man who had a kind of wanderlust, and he had extraordinary physical stamina and had longed all of his life to go on some sort of a grand tour of the deep interior of the continent. And I had known of this interest for some time, but I hired him to be my private correspondence secretary, although I didn't really use him in that capacity, and aide-de-camp. He did take some presidential messages here and there, and including my annual State of the Union message to Congress, and he did some personal errands for me during the course of my time there. But I really hired him not for what became the Lewis and Clark expedition. I hired him because I wanted his expertise in reducing the size of the army. And since he had served as an officer in the Army of the West, he would know which officers were better to be perpetuated than others, which should be retired, which ones were vile Federalists and really didn't have any place in what I called the Second American Revolution. So Lewis and I lived alone, and I wrote to my daughter Martha and said, we are as quiet as two church mice, the two of us, in this great barn of a building. So the idea that there are hundreds there now is something that I have a hard time imagining. And then there are millions of federal employees. I assume they're not all in the White House, but that's very upsetting to a person of my time.
Mr. Wright, if I might ask you to share with President Jefferson. Now, recently I had a conversation with him, and he described Washington during his presidency as the city as a howling wilderness. It's a howling wilderness no more. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir, that is correct. Today, Washington, the metropolitan area of Washington, is of several million different people. Washington, I think, is known not, of course, just as the capital of the United States, but as a hub of culture and diplomacy and sort of geopolitics. Washington really is the epicenter, I think, for global politics outside of the United Nations in New York. It is a hurly-burly, exciting city, but perhaps not what you experienced, Mr. Jefferson. Mr. President, could you tell us what Washington was like in your day?
Well, it was I think Gouverneur Morris, the Federalist sarcast, said it's a great city for future habitation. In my time, there wasn't much. It was still really just a sort of a lonely hillside along the Potomac. It was placed there for two reasons. One, it was close to Mount Vernon, and the first president was eager for it to be close to his ancestral home. But it also was placed there because it put it in the middle of the country. You know, the chances of putting it in New York or Philadelphia were high, but they were not central, and they had a colonial past to endure. And so I was one of those who wanted to clear a place in the wilderness and build a capital from the grassroots up. And we did prevail in that, although Alexandria and Georgetown were nearby. But in my time, a few thousand people lived in what you would call the District of Columbia or its environs. And Pennsylvania Avenue was made of mud. There were tree stumps still lingering. Hogs were rooting in the streets. Horses and carriages got bogged down in their journeys from the Capitol over to the White House. The White House grounds weren't completed. In fact, when I moved in, the stairs had not yet been completed. The Adams were still burning fires day and night to try to dry the plaster during their short tenure in the White House. And the White House in my first term particularly was really the only hospitality place in the city. And every congressman, even those who loathed me politically, begged for invitations to my White House dinners because it was the only place they could get anything like good food, especially French cuisine, and, of course, the fine wines that I routinely served there. So I think we're talking about eras so widely separated that they hardly bear any comparison or resemblance whatsoever, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. And also, thank you to our very special guest, Mr. Beau Wright. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Right now, we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. We are joined in our weekly conversation by Mr. Beau Wright, who spent 5 years as an aide in the White House. Are you still with us, Beau?
Yes, sir, I am.
Could you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yes, I'm from Lynchburg, Virginia, which is about an hour south of Charlottesville. Mr. President, you may know this area well. I believe you do. I'm sitting here a few miles from Poplar Forest.
Oh, my.
Actually, as I speak to you now.
That's a very remote part of Virginia. What takes you there, sir?
I grew up not far from here, and I have, after my time in Washington, I decided to, I think much as you did, I decided to retire, so to speak, to Virginia and to my home here in Lynchburg.
And so are you a farmer, I hope?
No, Mr. President, I'm afraid not. Although I embrace your agrarian philosophy, I'm afraid that I'm what we today call an operations director. And so my job function is to ensure that my organization, the organization I currently work for, that they have the administrative resources that they need to succeed. So I am in charge of budgets and physical resources to ensure that my colleagues from my current organization are able to do their jobs without having to worry about the administrative details.
Well, I have to say I didn't understand a single word of that, but I take you on faith, sir. Before we go back to the White House, how is Poplar Forest doing? I hope it's good.
Oh, Mr. President, I hope that you would be impressed. So the home after you left it, I believe, went through several different families. Several different families owned it, and it has been lovingly and quite painstakingly restored to its appearance when you lived there, sir. It is exquisitely preserved. They frequently host the public at Poplar Forest, especially on 4th of July, which I know was an important day for you.
It was, including, of course, at the White House. At Poplar Forest, I was always concerned about the dining room, which is a 20 by 20 by 20 foot pure cube, but it had a skylight on the roof, and the skylight always leaked. How's it doing now?
Sir, as I understand it, it's doing quite well. You may have heard of Travis McDonald, who is a local to the Lynchburg area, and he is in charge out there at Poplar Forest, ensuring that the house is in tip-top shape. And so I'm sure if he ends up listening to this, that he would want me to say that your skylight is no longer leaking.
Bo, during our break, Mr. Jefferson appealed to me that he would like the opportunity to ask some specific questions about the White House today. Would that be all right?
Yes, sir, it would.
So which president did you serve? Was it Jackson or Madison?
No, Mr. President, I served President Obama, Barack Obama, who was our 44th president.
And I don't know how to put this delicately, but is it true that he was a Negro?
He was of mixed parentage. His mother was a white woman from Kansas, or her family originated in Kansas, and his father was a gentleman from Kenya.
From Africa?
Yes, sir.
And so in your time, a black man became the president of the United States?
Yes, sir, that's correct. That is not to say, however, that race relations aren't still a matter of incredible importance in our day and age. It very much is. I think the story of race in America, which I understand you are quite familiar with, is something that we are still wrestling with as a society today, though I think many of us would indicate that, or certainly many of us were thrilled that President Obama was elected, as I think it marks a new and very positive stage in the development of the American culture.
It certainly suggests that you have overcome some of the prejudices of my time. And what was your function in the White House, sir?
Yes, Mr. President, I was the director for finance. And so in my role, I was responsible for managing the White House office appropriation. So we had an annual appropriation from Congress. And my responsibility was to ensure that it was budgeted for appropriately and apportioned and dispersed appropriately and according to applicable legal guidelines.
Well, that's an extraordinary responsibility. I don't know if you know this, but in my time, there was no White House appropriation. I was paid $25,000 per year, and I was expected to pay for all costs relating to my time as president from that fund.
You may be surprised, Mr. President. The President of the United States now makes $400,000.
Oh, my. And he pays for all of the functions and receptions and hospitality and dinners and so on.
No. In fact, funds exist to accommodate for those types of events, those types of official representative events. So, for example, if a foreign leader were to come to the White House, the State Department and the White House would work together to make sure that event was funded appropriately.
Oh, my. Well, tell me at least that you still serve French wine.
Mr. President, I'm afraid to say that I don't know that we do. The president may serve French wine in his private quarters. I can't say for sure. Though I do know that to the best of their ability, the White House chefs today do try to serve food that is uniquely American and sourced here in America, and that goes for American wines, which are produced all around the country, including many excellent vintages here in Virginia.
I would be very surprised if that were true, sir. To equal Bordeaux wines, I thought it would take centuries, maybe millennia, in the United States, and it's not even clear to me that it's in our interest to compete with wine when it is as perfected as it has been by the best French vignerons. But let me ask a different question. You were one of several hundred White House employees. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
So where was your bedroom in the White House?
Well, Mr. President, these days, in my time, the White House staff live off campus, so to speak. Nobody lives on campus except for the president and the president's family. So I lived in Southeast Washington, which I don't even I don't believe was extant when you were in the executive mansion.
I see. And how often did you actually encounter the president?
Well, I have to confess to you, Mr. President, I was a junior aide, so my encounters were infrequent. We had a sort of an unwritten rule that you should be where you're meant to be. In other words, my job was to handle the finances, and so I ought to be at my desk. Now, if the president or a member of the senior staff were to have a question about the budget, that would filter down through channels, and I might be responsible for briefing a member of the senior president's staff, should he so choose, and then the individual might brief the president. I did have occasion to be in the president's company or presence several times, and I think, Mr. President, that you would find that he was entirely befitting the office, an incredible man.
And did you travel with the president?
I did occasionally. So the president President Obama maintained a fairly rigorous travel schedule. And several times I had the incredible opportunity to be on his, what we call, advanced teams. So advanced teams are collectives of roughly 10 individuals of White House staff members, depending on the scope of the trip, who will go out in advance of the president by between 10, 14 days, give or take, to prepare for the president's impending visit. So several times I traveled on advanced teams ahead of the president. So I went when the president, he visited France, as it happens, and I went to Normandy ahead of him for about 10 days. And then the president last year visited California. He went to Yosemite National Park, and I preceded him there and helped prepare for his arrival and visit in Yosemite National Park.
So when you traveled for or with him, what sort of horse did you ride?
Well, as it happens, Mr. President, he doesn't require a horse anymore. I think the last president to have a horse, or at least have a carriage, was President Calvin Coolidge. Today, the president travels in vehicles, four-wheeled vehicles that are motorized, and that's when he's driving around town. But when he travels internationally or often any great distance over, say, 50 miles, he frequently travels by plane.
I have no idea what you just said. Let me ask you this. You mentioned a moment ago about the character of the president you served and questions of deportment and decorum. Can you expand upon that, sir, and tell me what you noticed and what you want to notice in a president?
Yes. The president is, as I believe, supposed to be first among equals. He's supposed to embody the traits of the American character that I think we all agree are particularly important to be represented both to ourselves and abroad. In other words, I think we expect the president to be the best among us. And President Obama, I think, embodied those characteristics. He's a man of extraordinary intelligence and insight. He's a compassionate, empathetic man. And he carried himself with a great dignity. I think that all too often, politicians are tempted, I think, to abuse the office or somehow misuse the office, and are often criticized as disrespecting the office that they hold. But President Obama, throughout his 8 years in office, I don't believe ever once was criticized by anybody in mainstream American politics for not carrying himself with absolute dignity and executing the functions of the office of the presidency with the highest integrity.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week, we're so pleased to be joined in our conversation by Mr. Beau Wright, who wrote to us several weeks ago, and we contacted him, asked him to join us on the show, and he was gracious enough to do so. And Beau, you served, I believe you said, 5.5 years in the previous administration. That gives you a very unique perspective, one that few Americans would ever get, and that is to witness the day-to-day details and operations within the White House and be part of all of that. So my question is having spent that time and watching this previous president, did you find anything about him and his policies to be Jeffersonian?
Yes, though I think, and I'm sorry, Mr. President, if this offends you, I think that our two major parties today are probably a blend of Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian ideas. And so I think in that regard that President Obama probably is a healthy blend of both, if we think that the parties are sort of a fusion of those ideals.
And if a blend could be said to be healthy, sir, I understand that the world is different in your time from in mine, but I believe that this Obama believed in a relatively strong central government, did he not?
He did. But he's also a man of science.
How so?
So he embraced science. He was a peerless advocate for the scientific endeavors by the federal government. He ensured that that funding for scientific agencies, federal agencies, was as robust as he could get through the Congress. And he empowered scientists and young people around the country to pursue the sciences, mathematics, physics, computer technology, and which I understand might be alien to you, Mr. President.
I had a chemistry kit in the White House. I don't know if you know this. I wonder if your president engaged in any chemical experiments there.
He did indeed. So every year, the White House hosted a science fair for students across the country who submitted projects. And if they were exceptional enough, the students were invited to the White House, and the president would come to the East Room and visit with the students and see the projects and participate in science experience. Many of them came with interactive exhibits for the president to try out. So not only did he empower the sciences, he was a man of letters. President Obama is a exceptional writer and has written several books, several treatises, which were very well received. So he's an interesting blend, I think, of Jeffersonian ideas, but also a belief in a strong central government, which I know you, Mr. President, were not enthusiastic about.
You say he is a writer of some note. You know, and when I was president of the United States, I literally wrote everything that ever came out of my office. That I had no ghostwriters, no speechwriters. I didn't even use my private correspondence secretary to do anything but occasionally copy out a letter that I had already written. Do you have any sense of this, how modern presidents, to what extent they write themselves and to what extent they're dependent upon others?
Today in the White House, we have a number of offices that are responsible for managing the processing of the president's papers. There are several. I want to answer your question, Mr. President, in several fashions. So we have the Office of Presidential Correspondence, which is responsible for handling all of the physical correspondence that the president receives, letters mainly. But the president now also receives electronic communication, electronic letters by email from thousands of constituents every year that must be responded to. And so there is a team of 50 or so staff members in today's White House who handle all the president's correspondence. And they work closely with members of the president's staff secretary's office. So the president has a staff secretary, and that individual is responsible for managing the flow of paper across the president's desk. Today, the amount of material is so voluminous that the president has to review that it is unfair, I think, to ask the president to manage all of that himself. He would be inundated with paper otherwise.
Does he write anything? Does the president write any of his own correspondence?
Yes, Mr. President, he does. So at least President Obama requested that every day he receive 10 letters from ordinary Americans who had written to them. And he would read those every night and reply to them by hand. And then occasionally when he was traveling around the country, he would meet with letter writers to talk to them face to face.
How is his handwriting? Does he have a good hand?
He's left-handed, and he does have a good hand. It's a distinctive scrawl. I understand, Mr. President, that you had particularly fine penmanship.
I don't like the word scrawl, sir.
My apologies, Mr. President.
If he has a scrawl, then he is not an artist with the pen.
He has a distinctive style.
Can you read it?
Yes, you can. Indeed.
Well, that's the most important thing, of course.
Gentlemen, I hate to interrupt, but we need to bring this conversation to a close.
We were just getting started, sir. I have so many questions.
Well, perhaps Bo would come back another time via this device and talk to you again, sir.
I'd like him to go to Poplar Forest for me because I have some questions.
I would be very surprised if you did not have a few more questions for Mr. Wright. And in fact, sir, he may have some questions for you. Bo, would you be willing to stay with us just a bit longer?
I'd be delighted.
Excellent. Right now, we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
And welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I'm Clay Jenkinson. Sitting across from me here in the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn is Mr. David Swenson, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And across the country, David, Mr. Bo Wright, formerly a member of the Obama administration, and he does say that he actually met that president. Fantastic.
Well, we got a letter from Bo, and I'm not going to read it because it would embarrass the both of us. It was so kind. But I read it and went, I wonder what it would be like to have Mr. Jefferson talk to him. And the results were pretty fun.
But, I mean, you see the point of all those ridiculous questions about Jefferson's assumptions. Jefferson met guests at the door in his slippers.
Jefferson got a little edgy there at the end, you know. What was this thing about?
Penmanship,
his penmanship. Yeah, come on.
Well, if you're going to praise Obama as some sort of a writer, then I want to know what his penmanship.
I'm thinking that maybe Jefferson was a little overloaded by the technology we use today, and maybe he was a little overloaded by the factual nature of the White House during our time. I mean, and maybe a little bit upset about how big the central government is.
Yeah, think about it. So, okay, he gets paid $500,000 per year, plus he has an unlimited expense account, plus he has a million employees.
Yeah, so it's understandable.
You know, so Pierce Jefferson, who dies bankrupt.
Meanwhile, waiting on the phone, and thank you for waiting, is Bo Wright. And really, thanks for reaching out to us. Thanks for being a supporter of the show. Thanks for the great letter, and I think you have a new gig. We need a Washington correspondent.
I'll take it.
So let me ask you a serious question, Bo. So I know a little bit about people who work for important men and women, and it's for the young. It's for people who are willing to give 18, 19, sometimes 22 hours a day to this. You don't get a lot of sleep. The pressures are gigantic. Of course, the joys of it, being so close to the center of the action is fantastic, but it's a pretty demanding role. And you went up. I want to hear how you went from intern to apparently running the country. But secondly, how could you ever have time to listen to something as frivolous as the Thomas Jefferson Hour? I guess that's our question.
Well, I listen to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Oftentimes, I would listen to it on my commute or while I was getting ready in the morning. So I think for most of us, the only time that we really had to enjoy podcasts or Netflix or what have you was in the late evenings and early mornings. So I was a pretty devoted follower of the Thomas Jefferson Hour while I was riding to and from work. And I think most of my colleagues are aware of this. I would frequently come in and mention that I'd just been listening to Thomas Jefferson Hour, and this is what they had been talking about this week. So I think that they'll probably be tickled to know that I'm now talking with you, and it's a pretty exciting opportunity for me because I've been following what you all have been doing, and it's really incredible work.
But at no point in all of this time did you walk into the Oval Office and say, "Mr. President, you have got to listen to the Thomas Jefferson Hour." At no point did you do that, did you?
Bo, don't answer that. Let's just leave that out.
At no point did he actually swing open the door. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
All right, moving along.
So now you're in a completely different world. What made you choose Southwestern Virginia? I've been to Poplar Forest. It's magnificent.
Sure.
It is a pretty remote part of the state.
Oh, but it's a beautiful part of the state. And I grew up here. My family's been here in Central Virginia since the early 1700s.
Wow.
So I guess they were contemporaries with President Jefferson. And so coming back to Lynchburg, just made sense. My job is remote. My team is still based out of Washington, but the good news is that I get to work here, in Lynchburg and be near to family, and enjoy this community that I love quite deeply.
As you know, Bo, there are people who are listening to this show who think that President Obama was an extraordinary human being who never was, taken as seriously as he ought to have been and is one of the great presidents of our time. And then there are others listening to the program who can hardly stand to hear the word Barack Obama and regard him as a man who was bent on destroying America as we know it. Opinions are so violently varied about this man. And so I know people will understand that as a person who worked for him, you had a special point of observation, and we take your observations with great delight. The current president, let's put it this way, is not elegant, is not a man of deep decorum. From your point of view, how serious a problem is that? Forget his politics, forget his what he wants to do with the country, but his deportment, how serious is that an issue for you?
I think for anybody who observes the presidency, whether you've worked there or not, you really do want the president to represent America well. I think this is especially important abroad. I think it hinders our international relationships when the president behaves in such a fashion that it is difficult for other countries to understand what his motives are, to understand or anticipate what we might do. But it's also just important, I think, for the example that he sets to the American people. I don't think that many of us, and again, I understand that, politics aside, I don't think that any of us would probably recommend engaging in tweet storms at 5 a.m. in the morning that target individual citizens.
But there are citizens that believe that
Trump is saying what the country needs to say, and it's about time that someone could talk that way, and that there's nothing wrong with telling it like it is, and so on. And so you've heard this, of course.
Yes, but I think it. I guess I'm a small C conservative in that regard. I think that that there is a level of discourse that we should expect of a president. We should expect a certain amount of civility, and there is a way to say the honest truth forthrightly, but in a kind and empathetic and constructive fashion. I coming from this White House, I don't see the same level of commitment to civility in American discourse that I think we all expected and would have vilified President Obama had he not engaged in, and previous presidents. I think, you know, presidents in modern American history have all, up until today, have all exhibited a certain amount of decorum. And we should expect that, and we should insist on it, because it's good for our republic. It's healthy for our republic.
You know, Bo, you've had such a fortunate beginning of your career, and I'm sure lots of people listening envy that. It must have been very heady to be part of a pivotal administration in American history, the first African American president, and the initiatives. You know, here's how I see it. I'm much older than you are. I have a living memory of every president from John Kennedy on, and in my lifetime, forget his politics, I think it's fair to say that Barack Obama was the most elegant, most dignified, best spoken, most articulate, most self-restrained president of that whole group, and that includes John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. I mean, you can dislike Barack Obama for lots of reasons, and plenty do, but in terms of the dignity that he brought to the office, I can't think of anyone who has done better than he did in that regard. Can you?
No, I agree with you. I think you can object to anybody's politics, but I firmly believe that you can't object to this, to President Obama's character. I mean, it is unimpeachable, and I can't think of anybody else who would disagree, except to score political points.
Well, there'd be plenty to disagree. What's the craziest, most anarchic, least responsible thing you did when no one was looking in the White House? What did you do that you would never want anyone except a Jefferson Hour person to know?
President Obama had a saying, or at least, I don't know, I never heard him actually say it, so it may be apocryphal. But you know, if you wouldn't want this to wind up on the front page of the Washington Post, don't do it. And so that was sort of our rubric.
You were talking with Clay prior to the show about how you left the White House, what's expected, how that all works. And I think listeners would like to hear that. And also, I want to give you an opportunity to tell us what you're doing now.
Sure. So I assume you're asking about the transition period.
Right.
You know, after the election, day after, and actually well in advance, we started preparing for the transition, you know, a long time, months, if not well over a year. But for most of us, we'd been planning for months by the time the election actually came around. Because as President Obama insisted, if you watch it, he gave a Rose Garden speech the day after the election, and he said that we will do our utmost to ensure a peaceful, smooth transition of power, because as much as it helps the Trump administration, it's also just in the good interest of the country. We want the next administration to be successful because it's good for America. So we spent the next 2 months working with the incoming administration to ensure that they had all of the resources that they needed and information that they needed to take over. And then we said our goodbyes. You know, one thing about working there is that you always know that there's a horizon to your time, which is a helpful reminder not to both take your own role or yourself too seriously, because you will soon be leaving, but also just to cherish and relish every moment that you get to spend on that very special campus.
Indeed. And so now you are living in Lynchburg and you're working. Just give us a quick summary of the kind of work you do again.
Sure. So I am working with United to Protect Democracy, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that is seeking to preserve democratic norms and institutions, something I think that, you know, we discuss often here, or you all discuss often here on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And so that's our focus, ensuring that that we don't, we don't engage in a slide towards, say, you know, an autocracy or an authoritarian government.
Wow, that's a heavy burden for this and all subsequent presidencies. You know, whatever you think of Donald Trump, the presidency has grown into a unitary business. More and more power accrues to the executive branch. Autocracy is going to be a Jeffersonian issue in these questions. Let me ask you a last question. I don't know if you know this, but we're from North Dakota. North Dakota's first millionaire and its most colorful millionaire was a man named Harold Schaefer, and he gave us Snowy Bleach and Mr. Bubble and other products. And then he went on to become North Dakota's greatest philanthropist, and he created the gateway town Medora for Theodore Roosevelt National Park, along with a pitchfork fondue and a Medora musical and so on and so forth. His granddaughter, a woman named Ellie Schaefer, the daughter of Governor Schaefer of North Dakota, and this is a very, very Republican family, wound up being an events coordinator in the Obama White House, and I think you knew her.
I did indeed. Ellie was a special assistant to the president and director of the White House Visitor's Office. So her job was to manage all the Easter egg rolls, any of the big functions that might happen at the White House, and especially the public functions on the South Lawn. That was Ellie's domain. And I think she is rightly known around Washington, and I assume back in North Dakota, as somebody of tremendous talent.
Enormous talent and a force of nature and a brilliant, brilliant woman. And what
indeed.
Easter egg doesn't cover it. I mean, she was handling things of such importance that it's hard to chart them. In spite of all the abuse, will you come back as a regular correspondent on this program?
If you would have me, I would love to.
Okay, you got to go to Poplar Forest. You got to go to the Natural Bridge. You're going to have to infiltrate Monticello.
No. Let me be the first to say thank you so much. It's just been a delight getting to know you. I look forward to talking to you again. But now it is time to say goodbye because it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Well, it's time for the annual Lewis and Clark cultural tour in Montana and Idaho. As usual, I go kicking and screaming because I am never ready when the moment comes, not physically and not spiritually. And I have so much to do back in civilization that I let myself think I don't have time for pleasure in the wilderness. By the time I meet the 25 or so participants, mostly Jefferson Hour folks, from around the United States in the back of a motel in Great Falls, Montana, I'm pretty ragged. My trunk is filled with duffels and sleeping bags and life vests and books, but far the more burdensome baggage is in my heart and soul. How does it happen? How do we get so busy with our lives, so stuck in routines, that we surrender our autonomy and sometimes our integrity and become not much more than robots going through the motions of life, but with pretty anemic vital signs? I know this much, that it is essential to my happiness that I break my routines a few times per year, get out into some heartbreakingly beautiful, lonely place in the American West where I can sit under the stars at night, listen to the crooning of the coyotes, contemplate the ways in which the limber pines sway and dance in the nocturnal breeze, watch for shooting stars, breathe deep, and let the accumulated noise and angst and strain slip out of my soul to be drawn down the great river towards the Gulf of Mexico. Yes, Becky will attempt to drown me, as always, and about 90 minutes into the 9-mile vertical hike up Wendover Ridge, while I'm bent over coughing up a lung, I will vow again never, ever, ever to do this hike. But later that night, after a glass or two of fine red wine, sitting with other serenely smiling Wendover survivors around a lovely campfire, I feel more spiritually reintegrated than I would have thought possible. Among other things, I find myself back into my body after a period of being only lightly anchored in that body. Thoreau said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." Jefferson was about as civilized a man as I have ever encountered in my reading. He loved nature with a capital N, but he was not much for camping. I doubt that Jefferson would enjoy the summer cultural tour very much. He was not one for roughing it. In this respect, my heart is more with Captain Lewis, who thrived more in wilderness than in Philadelphia, and with Thoreau and John Muir and Aldo Leopold, than with the severely civilized Mr. Jefferson. There is a moment on the second day of the canoe trip through the White Cliffs section of the Missouri River, through what Meriwether Lewis called scenes of visionary enchantment, when most of us slip out of the canoes and into the great river, well protected by life vests, and just float on our backs down to the evening camp, letting what Lewis called the mighty and heretofore deemed endless Missouri do all the work. We camp precisely where Lewis and Clark did 200 years ago, wine, beer, and hors d'oeuvres are waiting for us. But for about an hour, we bob down the great river like characters out of Huckleberry Finn. And when you finally surrender to the river and the magical landscape through which it flows, surrender to the mingling of the wide land and the big sky that is Montana, my life soon begins to feel like paradise on earth. And oh my, do I need that rebirth and renewal this year. Becky, I'm on my way. Be gentle with your fractured Captain Lewis. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week, if I live, for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.